Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Back in the day, way back, Americans made candy at home and pulled it out for a party. Now, we buy it at the store in bags the size of jack-o'-lanterns, and on Halloween, it rules. My guest today calls herself the Candy Professor. She knows the history, the candies, the brands, the evolution, and she's thought a lot about American tastes and diets and attitudes toward candy right now. This hour on Point, our tricky relationship with candy. You can join the conversation. Do you love it, hate it, want it, run from it? Where does our big debate on food, health, and pleasure leave candy? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Halloween's coming, going to be a lot of candy out there. Here's a vintage animated Tootsie Roll ad. A child rabbit, a chipmunk, they wear Indian headdresses and dance in the woods and celebrate their candy.
Clap your hands, stamp your feet. Chocolatey Tootsie Roll Snapsy Beat. Wink your eye,
say it's great.
The best taste of candy you ever ate.
Let's give a cheer.
Hip, hip, hooray.
We eat Tootsie Roll every day.
We eat Tootsie Rolls every day. I don't know how that goes down now. We're going to hear later in this hour from David Kessler, former FDA commissioner on food and candy. But joining me first from New York is Samira Kawash. She is also known as the Candy Professor, Professor Emerita at Rutgers University. She spent her academic career studying architectural theory, women, medicine, and the imagery of terrorism. Now she's thinking full-time about candy, writing a book on the cultural history of candy. Her blog is candyprofessor.com. Samira Kawash, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. I'm so happy to be here, and happy Halloween.
Well, happy Halloween. We'll look at Halloween and how candy and Halloween came to be so tightly associated with one another. But I wish you'd take us right on back, because you've got a really big take on candy, kind of where it comes to us from, out of the mists of time, and then you really dive in around the year 1900 and think about, you know, who made candy, where it came from, how it came into people's everyday lives. Take us in the way, way back machine, Samir, and give us a sense of candy's history and how it came sort of roaring forward a century ago and more.
Well, it's so funny. 1900 is the way, way back machine, isn't it?
Mm.
1900, around that time, is when candy starts to get really interesting, because candy is rapidly transformed at the end of the 19th century from something that is made by hand and very labor intensive to something that is made by machines and increasingly in mass quantities. And it's really the explosion of machine technology at the turn of the century, which transforms every industry, of course, but it transforms candy too. And all of a sudden, where there were only a few candies that might be available sometimes in scarcity, suddenly there is a vast explosion in the kinds of candy, the amount of candy, the price of candy, of course, goes way down.
Samira, hold the button on the machinery for just a second.
Sure.
And take us back to that before then, just so we kind of understand how people deeper in history looked at it and made it. I mean, before you turned on the machine and pumped it out in the thousands and millions of pieces, that earlier period you're describing, give us a little more tactile sense of it. I mean, how often did people go to the trouble to make candy? Why was it labor-intensive? Where did it sit in their lives, their sense of what to eat, for what purpose or occasion?
Well, it would depend on where you lived and who you were.
Mm-hmm.
For most of the period when refined sugar is available, since about the 15th century, sugar was very expensive. And so candy, which is basically pure sugar, would have been something available only if you had quite a lot of extra money that you could spend on a luxury like sugar. So people might get candy at holidays, like at Christmas time was always a traditional time to get a stick of candy in your Christmas stocking or your Christmas shoe.
The candy cane or the sassafras stick or whatever it
was.
That's
right. But it would be something for a very special occasion, because sugar was so dear and you didn't want to waste it on just that little pleasurable morsel.
In movies now, when we look back to the 19th century, you know, it's not uncommon to have that sort of big glass round jar of sassafras sticks, even on the counter in the saloon. I mean, was it part of the retail culture as Americans moved across the country, moving west?
Well, as American society grew and as communities grew that could support things like candy making, you know, there might be some place in a larger town that somebody would be making things like those sassafras sticks and making them available. But, you know, as I say, it was something in small quantities and not very much variety and probably not something that everybody had access to all the time.
And when people made it at home, what kind of sweets, candies did they tend to make?
You know, that home candy making is really something that comes around the end of the 19th century. Earlier, if you made candy at home, the most likely thing you would make is molasses candy, which is basically just boiled down molasses. But for 19th century Americans, that was also medicinal. It was used for, you know, respiratory ailments and also for digestive ailments.
So people would – where do you draw the line here? What's candy? I mean, fudge and all that stuff, Panucci and all that. Was that candy in the 19th century? Is that candy now? Is that –
Where do you draw the line at candy? I mean, I think that's actually one of the most interesting questions that I've been thinking about as I study candy, because it's clear today when we look at the candy scene that the line between candy and food has become a little bit complicated. But certainly for people in the 19th and early 20th centuries, you know, those very concentrated sugar treats, which would have required special equipment and special expertise, were clearly a kind of thing that was, you know, the category of candy was much, much more clear.
So when the machinery shows up just after the turn of the last century, what did that mean? How did that change the kinds of candy that were made and available? What did it look like?
Well, one of the kinds of candies that became available were molded candies. Someone figured out that if you used cornstarch and put it in a tray and punched out little molds in that, that you could make candy in all different shapes. So one of the candies that was only available commercially that became very popular at the turn of the century was molded jellies, all that. Well, candy corn is a kind of what they called buttercream, but those were molded in all kinds of shapes at that time. And also molded marshmallows were incredibly popular. In fact, one of the most popular candies at the turn of the century was marshmallow, which surprises me so much because we don't really think of marshmallow as a candy anymore. We buy it at the grocery store.
So a little away from the fudge and brittle and taffy and molasses boiled down to these. Was it big business? At first, was there an immediate market? Did the, you know, the big manufacturers, you know, just churn it out and the Americans bought it and ate it?
What? Well, like everything, it grew over time. But by the 19-teens, it was a big enough business to have, you know, well, I should go back to even the 1880s. There was, you know, substantial candy makers in cities like Chicago and Brooklyn, and there were enough of them with enough of a business to start being concerned about protecting their business and about promoting their business. So really, even starting in the late 19th century, we see the beginnings of a kind of business self-consciousness and a way of trying to think about how to promote candy and how to sell candy and how to make candy something that will appeal to people.
So mass production takes off, but then you point to another kind of watershed, the World War II universe and post-World War II. What happened in there mid-century?
Well, during World War II, I think during World War I, two things happened.
Oh, one. Is it, World War I is,
well,
the, is the...
Well, you said between World War I and World War II, so we're talking the 20s and 30s, right? So during World War I, sugar was in shortage. And because there was less sugar, candy makers had to come up with different ways of making candy. They couldn't use as much sugar anymore. And so they developed all kinds of other things to fill their candies with. And so we have the invention of basically the modern candy bar because, well, let's put oat flakes in there. Let's put corn flakes in there. Let's put caramel and nougat
bulk
and nuts.
And, okay.
And bulk it up, exactly. Mm-hmm. So that bulked up candy bar was really the result of, you know, what are we going to do? How can we make candy when we're having these big shortages because of the war? And when the soldiers came back from World War I, they were hungry for candy. The military had provisioned the troops with lots of candy because in those days candy was considered good energy food, and I would love to talk more about that, so let's get back to that. But they came back, they were hungry for candy. Eating candy was manly and strong, and really the you know, the glory days of American candy were really in the 20s and 30s.
So was it marketed for, you know, for joy, for pleasure, for health? For, you said there's even a link between candy and medicine if you go back far enough. I mean, in the way it's marketed. But how was it sold? Just to have a good time or, you know, I don't know, make yourself stronger, get up and go?
Actually, the candy industry worked very hard in the first part of the 20th century to promote candy as food. And so it wasn't for pleasure. It was for energy. And It was energy that happened to taste good. So what candy had going for it was really concentrated energy food, and it also happened to be enormously pleasurable. And so we have today now such anxiety about what candy really is, and so the marketing focuses much more on pleasure. But in the first part of the century, the idea that the calories in candy were a very good source of energy was really at the center of candy marketing for the first part of the century.
But you've also written that there was always this sense of menace around candy, you know, maybe like the apple in Snow White, that there might be something poison or something wrong or something impure about the candy, once it became commercial in particular.
It's so interesting to see these two very strong sensibilities about candy sort of hand in hand through the century. And I sort of call them candy boosterism and candy alarmism. Mm-hmm. And they're absolutely linked. On the one hand, candy is food and we can eat it and enjoy it. And on the other hand, candy is poison. And there's something about candy, whether it's something in the candy that contaminates it or the candy itself, that will lead to something terrible. And we think about the idea of, you know, cavities. The idea that candy would cause cavities was first surfaced in the early 20th century. The idea that one thing that happened quite frequently through the teens and 20s was when children got sick, the first diagnosis was poison candy. And there was an idea that children were eating candy, there was something wrong with the candy must be the thing that poisoned them. Now, it turned out that was never the case, but it was like the first diagnosis.
Who can take tomorrow, dip it in a dream? Separate the sorrow and collect up all the cream. The candy man.
Willy Wonka.
The candy man can. The candy man can, 'cause he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good. And the world tastes good, 'cause the candy man thinks it should.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the trick or treat of candy. We love it. We hate it. We want it. We don't need it. We're looking at simple pleasures and our tricky relationship with the sweet stuff this hour with Samira Kawash, a.k.a. the Candy Professor. She's writing a book on the cultural history of candy. You can see candy and advertisements, old and new, at our website, onpointradio.org. You'll get a sense in a hurry of how the marketing has changed over the years. Here's a 1950s jingle for Good and Plenty, chewy licorice candy, now owned by Hershey's. According to the company, it's the oldest branded candy in the United States. This ad features Choo Choo Charlie, an engineer, fueling up his train with candy.
Once upon a time there was an engineer.
Choo Choo Charlie was his name, we hear.
He had an engine and he sure had fun. He's good and plenty candy to make his train run.
Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Charlie says, really rings the bell. Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Don't know any other candy that I love so well.
And then to Samira's point, here comes the narrator with the kind of scientific push for the benefits of this candy.
Active young Americans need plenty of energy. And Good and Plenty is famous for energy because it's rich in dextrose. Dextrose for quick energy. So join the crowd that cheers for America's favorite candy, Good and Plenty. It's plenty good.
Dextrose for energy. You can join us at 800-423-TALK. Randy in Augusta, Georgia, you're on the air with the Candy Professor.
Thank you very much. I go back a few years, and I remember a candy named Bonomo Turkey's Taffy, which has just been reintroduced, and I bought some. But it seems like the quality has really gone down. I feel like that might be a result of them replacing refined sugar with corn syrup, but I'd just like to hear your comments on that, how the quality of candy has gone down from when I was a kid.
Absolutely. Bonomo Turkish Taffy, don't know it, but it sounds like it could get you hooked in a hurry. Samira, what about it? The quality of candy overall, and particularly this move from refined sugar to so much corn syrup sweetener?
Well, I think it's a tricky question. Of course, our memories of what things tasted like when we were children, pass through the mists of time. And I know there's a lot of things I loved when I was a kid
right.
that I don't like so much anymore. As for Turkish taffy, I can't really say whether it's changed or not. But it's certainly the case that today it is the case that corn syrup is much cheaper than sugar. And when you're trying to make an inexpensive product, you know, sort of to mass market, you might want to substitute to cheaper ingredients. But it's also the case that this was happening in the 20s and 30s. The commercial we just heard for dextrose is corn sugar. Mm-hmm. And in the 40s, dextrose was all the rage, but it was also a cheap substitute for refined sugar.
Did it change the style of candy? What kind of candies were made when they moved from refined sugar to dextrose, corn sugar? Did we have different candies as a result?
You know, I'm not an expert in candy chemistry. Mm-hmm. Corn syrup was commercially available at the beginning of the 20th century, and the use of corn syrup in candy creates particular properties in candy. But as for what happens when you start substituting one sugar for another, I mean, that's the mystery of the candy laboratory. And certainly over the course of the century, food chemists have figured out different ways of substituting different sugars to create similar effects.
Now you write that the candy industry itself was a big proponent of the sort of pure food and monitoring of food so that people could feel confident that what they bought, candy included, wasn't going to hurt them.
Yes. Well, this was, we were speaking earlier about the fear that the candy was poisoned somehow. This was terrible for the candy industry. If people thought their product was poisoned with some kind of chemical adulterants or bad dyes or bad flavors that were going to hurt their children, nobody was going to buy it. So no one had more interest than candy makers in regulating and making Americans believe that the candy was good candy.
Let's go to Robin in Paulette, Vermont. Robin, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thank you.
Yes.
I just wanted to share something with the audience that I did with my children, who are now 4, 12, and 13. I grew up with a lot of candy. I had candy on the coffee table growing up, but I really saw an impact on their behavior. So like a lot of moms, I've really cut it out of their diet. And on Halloween, so that they're not feeling deprived, what I do is I let them choose the same number of years that they are. Let's say my 4-year-old will get to choose 4 pieces of candy out of his giant 5-pound bag that he's collected in the neighborhood, and then he'll leave that for the Great Pumpkin. And at night, the Great Pumpkin comes along and leaves him a gift and takes the candy and shares it with all the grandparents around the world. And
how's that going down with the kids, Robin, with your 4-year-old, with your 8 or what is it, 13?
I got away with it till about 11.
And then it's forget it, Mom.
13-year-old says, you know, I don't even know if I'm going because I don't get to keep the candy anyway.
I appreciate your call. It's a really tricky question, and I know you've thought a lot about it, Samira. We've got a comment here online from Flowen, who writes, "While I abhor all the sugar, chemicals, and corn that makes our U.S. factory food so good at maximizing profits instead of health and pleasure, I caution parents," she, I guess, writes, "from exerting too much control over children's eating. My sister-in-law strictly controls her daughter's intake of sweets, and as they grow up, they're obsessed with it." What do you say, Samira? There's a kind of a restraint strategy in Vermont and a warning on that front from Flowen?
Yeah, I think so much of our worry about children and candy has to do with precisely this issue of control. Who controls our children's bodies? And what are the consequences if we loosen our control? I think the fears that children were being poisoned by candy had something to do with that children had access to candy and were enjoying it by themselves. Maybe something bad will happen as a result. And I think today our efforts, many parents who are worried about candy and other bad things in children's diets, who seek to protect their children by controlling what goes into their body, listener mm-hmm. points out, mm-hmm. this can really backfire. And I think, you know, to think about separating the issue of, you know, what does our whole diet look like versus how are we treating this one particular thing, candy, as itself having some special badness to it.
Personal history on this front that may account for you now having sort of walked away from your old academic career to become the candy professor. You trace it right back to your own parents' handling of candy in your house.
Well, candy was very restricted in my house, and I think because my parents were concerned about, you know, that the candy wasn't good for you. And I think also that, you know, we came out of a sort of Protestant Catholic background, that candy was somehow, you know, a temptation that should be avoided, maybe almost sinful. And I think I loved candy. I wanted it all the time. If I could get my hands on it, I would gobble it down. I had all kinds of subterfuges to get some candy. And, you know, I think as when I became an adult and I could get candy for myself, that was really a problem because now I could get all the candy I wanted and I didn't really have any mechanisms for managing that. And it really, when I became a mother, made me think very hard about what I wanted to teach my daughter about what kind of relationship she could have with food and with treats.
Everybody's wrestling around with it. I was just fascinated to see you looking back and finding this big distrust of candy as a kind of historic element, even before people were thinking in these medical or dietary terms that we often do today. Let's go to Baltimore, Maryland, and Chris. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to make a comment about our body's ability to process sugar and how much sugar we have available to us in our diet these days. We're way behind from an evolutionary point of view. I mean, sugar in nature was a pretty rare thing in the diet, up until very recently.
Mm-hmm.
And towards the idea of all the diabetes that we see in our culture is largely a result of that kind of our bodies not catching up to what is available as far as sugar goes and processing sugar.
Yeah, so the sugar's there and plenty of it in the candy, but maybe in abundance, but maybe not an abundance of capacity to deal with that. If I may, yes, Samir, please.
I just want to point out that the role of candy in our diet today is very different than it was 100 years ago. And I think that your caller's point about the quantities of sugar that we're consuming is, I think this is a real issue of concern. But 100 years ago, when somebody had candy, they weren't also eating candy for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They were eating, eggs
as
and oatmeal.
As in sugared cereals and
yes.
Whatever else they've got on the plate.
Right. I think we need to look at candy in the broader context of what else we're eating and ask the question, why is it that candy is so easy to demonize, and why do we think that eliminating candy is going to solve all our problems? I think we need to be looking at all that other stuff that we eat and ask, is that really food?
Check out your breakfast. Check out your Gatorade. To help us do that, let's go to David Kessler. He is former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, a pediatrician, author of The End of Overeating, joins us from San Bernardino, California. David Kessler, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
We're talking about candy, its history, our attitudes toward it now. Of course, Halloween's just around the corner, and we heard this week, you no doubt saw it as well, Dr. Kessler, this report from the Centers for Disease Control, this projection, kind of mind-blowing, that by the year 2050, as many as 1 in 3 American adults could have diabetes. I don't know how that all figures into sugar and candy and the rest, but what do you see going on here, David Kessler?
Well, that number certainly, I think, caught us
shocking.
All with a great deal of surprise and concern. I think we all understood we have a growing problem in this country, no pun intended.
Mm.
But, I, as a pediatrician, 10-year-olds with type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is the accumulation probably of fat in muscle. And why do you have fat accumulating in muscle? It's because of excess calories that turn into fat, and that fat accumulation in muscle changes how the body metabolizes blood glucose. Today, we tend to see type 2 diabetes in, 50, 60-year-old. They're going to live for 2-3 decades. They're going to have the complications, the eye complications, the kidney complications, the cardiovascular complications, right? They'll live for 2-3 decades. Now we're seeing that disease in 10-year-olds who are going to live for 5, 6, 7 decades with that disease. And I, as a pediatrician, do not know. None of us have seen the complications. What does it mean to get type 2 diabetes when you're 10 years old and to live for 5, 6, 7 decades? What's that going to be like? And that scares me as a pediatrician.
I mean, we look at diabetes, leading cause of new cases of blindness among adults under 75, of kidney failure, of non-injury leg and foot amputations among adults. But help us look at this. I mean, because
it's
Halloween, people are going to...
diabetes.
Yeah.
I mean, three-quarters of us, right? Three-quarters of us are going to die from either cancer, cardiovascular disease, or stroke. And if you look at the underlying those three diseases, obesity really is a central cause of much of cardiovascular disease, certainly of stroke, and some forms of cancer.
Now, I know you've got a big theory of the case around food, and we'll hear it, but dial it back with us for just a second to candy. Halloween's coming. You know, kids are going out. It's a time of joy. Kids love getting that candy. They love taking it home. Do you take that away from them? Is that the answer? Is candy the problem, or how do you look at it?
You know, I think that, our colleague, the candy professor, I think has it pretty much right. The problem isn't candy once in a while. Right? I mean, obviously, life has to be pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, food has to be pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
It's that we've turned our food into candy. We're eating candy throughout our day.
What do you mean by that?
Look at what has happened over the last 3-4 decades. The food industry has learned to layer and load certainly sugar and fat. What's in candy? You know, it's refined sugar. Right? I mean, it's mm-hmm. highly concentrated. It's highly pleasurable. Right? I mean, sometimes there's fat in that candy. That increases the degree of pleasure. Right? Fat and sugar stimulate us to eat more and more. It's one thing if, did my grandmother cook with, you know, fat and sugar? Sure. We had it for dessert. Right? We had candy occasionally. Right? Now you load fat and sugar into all our foods. You put it on every corner. You make it available 24/7. I mean, the business plan of the modern American food company, the modern global food company, is to take fat and sugar, which in essence candy, put it on every corner, make it available 24/7, make it socially acceptable to eat anytime, make it into entertainment. We're living in a food carnival. We're eating candy all the time. It's just that we think it's food.
So this is going to sound like terrible killjoy, you know, outlook to a lot of parents and kids. What's your advice? I mean, to take away the candy bag or look at the whole diet and let them have it on Halloween? What?
No, so it depends. It's not the candy. Right? It's not that piece of candy that's the problem. It's how my brain thinks about that candy and thinks about that food. Right? If you look at that candy and say, I want that, that's going to make me feel good, I need that. Right? I mean, I was very interesting. You know, right before I got on,
mm-hmm.
Samira, the candy professor, was talking about how she got to the point where you could just listen to her and her voice. She wanted that candy.
I need that.
I need that. And that, once you get that, I mean, that's the learning, memory, habit, and motivational circuits. Understand the power of sweetness. Right? And it's not just the taste itself. Where does the power of food come from? Where does the power of sweetness come from? It's not just the taste, but it's the anticipation of the taste. I was talking to a gentleman. He said the hardest thing for him to do every day is at night, on the way home from work, to get on that train, there's this newsstand. Right? Mm. This is a big guy. Right, 250 pounds,
okay.
Right, runs a corporation, and the hardest thing for him to do every night is to run past that newsstand because there are those Kit Kats, right? And they call out to him.
And he's got to have it.
Well,
it's feels
interesting.
Like
if I ask you, what is it about, I mean, pick the vanilla milkshake, right? What is it about the vanilla milkshake that drives wanting? What do you think it is? You think it's the sugar? You think it's the fat? You think it's the flavor?
I'm going to have to hold the answer to that. We've got a break right here. Please stand by, David Kessler. It's great to have you with us. And Samira Kawash, the candy professor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
There's no telling what we can do or pretend. As long as I can get me some green M&Ms. Green M&Ms.
I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the trick or treat of candy. Halloween is nearly here, and you know what that means. Samira Kawash is with us, a.k.a. the Candy Professor. You can link to her blog from our website, all kinds of insights on candy. You can also see a lot of candy ads there, how the candy marketers get their hooks into us. Of course, it's fun to have those hooks in us, too. Also with us, David Kessler. He is former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, author of The End of Overeating, a pediatrician, joins us today from San Bernardino, California. And David, you had us on the edge of our seats with what it really is about that, I guess you were saying vanilla milkshake substitute, I don't know, Milky Way. But what is it about it that makes us say, I want that?
And it's wanting. That's, you know, that motivated, that driven quality. Is it the sugar? Is it the fat? Is it the flavor? The answer is, it's the sugar. Sugar is the main driver of wanting. But when you add fat to it, it's synergistic. It drives the motivational circuits. It activates those circuits that are involved in brain dopamine and stimulates wanting. How does that work? We get cued, right? You just think about your favorite candy right now. I bet you know, that memory, that past learning, it causes, that's a cue. A cue can be the sight, it could be the smell, it could be the time of day.
Thoughts of childhood come right along with it for me, I have to say.
Right, so and that cue, it causes an arousal, you start thinking about it, you focus your attention on that stimulus, that candy's in front of you, you want it, there's thoughts of wanting, you eat it, you keep on eating it. Right? If there's a lot, until it's all
candy
gone.
Corn, forget about it. But geez, it's Halloween, David, Dr. Kessler. I mean,
and that's fine. It's fine if you do it occasionally. Right now, we do it all the time. How do you look at that candy?
Yeah.
Right? Do you look at it as something that, you know? I mean, I will tell you a story, and I will admit this. Right? We had this drawer in our house.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called the candy drawer.
Yeah, a lot of people did or do.
Right. And my kids' friends would come over to the house and they'd be amazed, right? Because they said, your dad is who? What does he do?
Right.
I was running
again?
The FDA at the right. time and we had this candy drawer.
Great, Doc.
But it's interesting. If you, deprivation is not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you say, you can't have that and you want it, what's going to happen? Those cues are only going to arouse those thoughts, and you're going to keep those thoughts in working memory, and you're going to have that inner dialogue. Boy, that's good to me. No, I shouldn't have it. You have that ambivalence. If you look at the candy for what it is, I mean, what is it? I mean, if I blindfolded you and you tasted it, right, and you didn't even know what it is, and it didn't have all those other stimuli and those memories, I mean, what's candy? I mean, it's concentrated, it's refined sugar. I mean, it's fat.
I think I'd still figure
really
it out.
Is that really what you want?
Well, you know, very often, actually, as you say, yes, is what we want. But Samira, I wonder in this, you know, here's the former commissioner of the FDA. He's giving us the science of it, how it gets right into our sort of, I don't know, neurochemistry, wanting it. But within that, do you see the same old demonization of candy going on, Samira? Or is this a sort of new 21st century clean and scientific insight?
Well, I think it's fabulous that science can explain to us why we like candy so much. But, you know, even without science, it's pretty obvious. It tastes really good. I mean, the question is, how do we incorporate something that tastes really good into our diet? And, you know, the problem, and I completely agree with David Kessler on mm-hmm. this, you know, the candification of our food supply is a huge reason that we struggle so much now with this problem of health and obesity and diabetes, because we're really not just talking about the candy. We're talking about all of this other stuff.
Are we different as Americans on that front? You write about, talk about the French and how they look at sweets and say they've just got a different relationship. Now, they have the same, you know, evolutionary biology that we do. Is there something culturally different that makes our bags of candy the size of pumpkins?
I think we have that strong Puritan impulse in American culture, which is unique to our historical context. And I think that, you know, increasingly, as we have less and less of a sense of spiritual life, we focus more and more on our bodies and about purifying our bodies and putting good things into our bodies and figuring out what's good and what's bad and getting
rid of the
bad
stuff. The French are more spiritual, so they, they're less puritanical, so they eat less. I'm not following.
Social norms. Yeah. Social norms affect how my brain is going to react. Look at how the French eat. Right? They don't eat walking down the street. They don't eat between meals. They're not eating tons of candy. I mean, it's not socially acceptable to eat these huge portions. Let's take away labels. Let's not call it candy. Let's not call it food.
In other words, take away marketing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Let's call it what it is.
Piles of sugar.
It's sugar, right? It's sweetness. It's sweetness and fat. Right? And what have we done in the United States? We've taken sweetness and fat and put it on every corner. You cannot walk down Main Street for 15 feet. You can't walk into any store. You can't walk into a gas station. You can't walk into a drugstore without some cue, without some stimulus bombarding your brain that's sugar or fat. Call it candy, call it food. Our brains are being hijacked, literally. We've taken this very powerful stimulus, sweetness. We've amplified it. We've added fat to it. We've added texture. We've added color. We've made it into entertainment. We say, you know, you can have fun doing it. And we've put it out there. And that's fine when you realize it's us. But now think about our kids. And when you understand the behavior, right, it's not just that sweetness and fat, it's how my brain represents that sweetness and fat. And then my brain, as a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old, is constantly being hijacked.
Wow. You put it so powerfully. I mean, but at the same time, you know, there's an instinct to sort of hold the flag for pleasure here. How do we get the right balance? I want to hear from our listeners. Laz, Newport, Rhode Island. Laz, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
Oh, I'm all right. What do you know, Laz?
Right. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to make a couple very brief points. You know, I was sitting on the bus a couple of weeks ago, and I saw this gentleman in a wheelchair, and after a few days, I finally had the courage to ask him how, you know, about his amputated leg. He was obviously in the military, and I thought it was one of those IUD bombs or something.
IEDs, yeah. Maybe from Iraq. Had he served in Iraq or what?
Afghanistan. Apologies.
Okay. Yeah.
And I was shocked. I mean, he couldn't have been older than his mid-20s. I was shocked to learn that it was a year after he came home, it was diabetic-related. And then he said, well, what's worse is that my brother's foot is cut off. And I said, excuse me? He says, yeah, my brother's 29. His foot is cut off. And I said, is this running your family? He said, no, absolutely it doesn't. But what I find even more controversial is, you know, the industry's campaign to turn high fructose corn syrup into, quote, corn sugar, and all these other commercials, and then the entire industry trying to sort of deceive us.
Laz, that's an incredible story. He's an Afghan war vet, but his leg is not lost to an IED, but I guess to diabetes, you're telling us?
Yes, and I think it was more painful for him. The loss of leg wasn't as much as of a concern as he wished he would have lost it in Afghanistan, doing something, you know, more productive for his company than due to diabetes.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to let that sit right there. That story speaks for itself. And a foot gone too. My goodness, Virginia, Wakefield, Massachusetts. Virginia, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Yeah.
I believe that candy may have changed the history of our country.
How so?
Because I used to work in my youth. I'm an old lady now. I used to work for New England Confectionery Company.
Necco. Everybody knows Necco.
Yeah. And they made the Necco wafers.
Sure.
And we were told that the Necco wafers were given to the Union soldiers. And perhaps providing them with quick energy.
In the Civil War.
The most.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
So, you know, here we have the north and the south. Go north.
Yeah, so you're thinking maybe at Gettysburg the Necco wafers made the difference?
Who knows?
you may be onto something there. But, I mean, David, you know, it takes us back to a time when if those soldiers had a roll of Necco wafers, whether it was in the Civil War or World War One or World War II, they enjoyed those, and yet they weren't dying or facing 1 in 3 diabetes.
They didn't eat it constantly. It didn't, if you look at the amount of calories, it wasn't available. See, it's not just the fat and sugar alone. It's not just, you know, whether I want it or not. It's that we've made it socially acceptable to eat any time. We've made it accessible. Right? I mean, watch a child today. Right? The average 2-year-old compensates for their eating. What do I mean by that? You give the child more calories at lunch, they'll eat fewer calories throughout the rest of the day. By the time that child is 4 or 5, they lose the ability to compensate. What's going on is that they are eating constantly. The ability of the body to regulate itself is lost, and because we put this very stimulating fat and sugar throughout the day, call it candy, call it food, call it juice, call it soft drinks, but call it what it is, it's a powerful stimulus. They're eating for self-stimulation, and it doesn't stop, and it has enormous public health consequences.
Samir, I want to come to you. Yes, please.
Well, I just wanted to jump in because I think that the question, call it candy, call it food, actually matters quite a lot. And one of the things that I see with candy is by having something that we call candy and being able to put on candy the blame for all of our dietary woes, it makes it much easier to call the other stuff food. And, you know, a 600-calorie Cinnabon seems an adequate breakfast, but a 210-calorie Kit Kat seems sinful. You know, I think that that's, you know, because one is candy and one is not, we sort of are able to let it slide a little when it comes to the food thing. But
who's
we scrutinize
the
candy
the
thing.
Free ride? Who's giving?
Well, people eat them. I don't know who eats those.
It's so interesting. I mean, lots and lots of people do. They're all over the country. They're outlets. I mean, obviously, we're in the middle of a in some ways a health crisis, but also this amazing sort of cultural debate here about what to eat, what to call it.
And I see parents.
What do we do? I mean, where are we heading? And I do agree. Right? We do have to, and I think this is very personal. No food industry, no government, right? No book, no pundit can tell us what we want. And I think we need to do that for ourselves. I now look at these huge portions of fat, sugar, and salt, right, and say, I don't want it. I mean, I don't want all this highly processed food. Will I go eat good candy? Absolutely. But I eat it occasionally, and I understand I'm eating it for pleasure. But I have tried to, you know, I've tried to change how I look at food and how I look at candy and what I'm putting into my body. And I ask myself, am I just eating for stimulation or am I eating for pleasure? Am I eating for satisfaction? Am I?
Yeah, of course, you're up against an industry there. Here's another ad. This is for Bubble Tape Gum, big in the 90s, still out there. The marketing campaign here was aimed at preteens, and the slogan was, it's for you, not them.
The lunch lady wears a hairnet. Serves mashed potatoes with an ice cream scoop. What? Puts gravy on everything. She says,
bubble tape is not part of a well-balanced diet.
Bubble tape, it's 6 feet of bubble gum. For you, not them.
For you, not them. Kim in Winchester, Massachusetts. Kim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm just making sort of a call for clarity here. I'm the mom of a kid, an 8-year-old, who has type 1 diabetes. And
yes.
I wish when I hear the term diabetes, people would make the distinction. And one doctor did who called, but I have heard just the term diabetes used for the rest of the show. We've got to make the distinction between type 2 and type 1. Because I've got a kid who's got an autoimmune disease that has nothing to do with his metabolism, nothing to do with what he eats or how much exercise he gets. It's an autoimmune reaction in the body. But
absolutely.
I will tell you,
yes.
He has to look askance from people who think that what he's got has to do with what he's eating. So it's
right.
a daily battle of the parents of kids who have type 1. So just
Kim, I appreciate you making that distinction, and I'm really glad you called with that. Very quickly, David Kessler, just in a nutshell, the difference so people understand it here. It's not all coming off that food shelf.
I think your caller got it exactly right. Type 2 diabetes is related in the vast majority of circumstances to excess caloric intake. Type 1 is a disease where there's destruction of the pancreas cells, has nothing to do with obesity.
Samira Kawash, you've just got a minute here. I guess what I'm hearing you coming around to saying, don't lay it all on candy. Draw a line between what's candy, then look at the rest of what you're eating, and don't eat food that's, you know, as sweet and fatty and you name it as candy, but it masquerading as food.
Well, eat some eggs, eat some chicken, eat some salad, eat some apples, and then go trick-or-treating and have some candy.
It sounds like pretty good straightforward advice. David Kessler, you agree?
Decide what you want. Decide what you want to put in your body. Food can be pleasurable, but eat for nourishment, eat for satisfaction, eat for enjoyment. Don't eat just to be self-stimulated throughout the day.
And you better be prepared to do a little bit of battle with a whole lot of marketing in trying to follow that very good advice. I'm really grateful to both of you for being with us this hour. David Kessler, former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, joining us today from San Bernardino in California. Dr. Kessler, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
And Samira Kawash, the candy professor, she's got a blog at candyprofessor.com. Check it out. Samira, we're really grateful to you for your historical work, your cultural work, and we'll keep reading. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
Samira Kawash is writing a book on the cultural history of candy. Listeners, thanks for joining us. Enjoy your Halloween. Anyway, you do it. Here's Bow Wow Wow with I Want Candy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Have a great weekend.